I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and this is the late Lucy Greeley talking about the brutal affliction that tormented her brief life, yet made her famous. She was struck down with cancer of the jaw as a child, which left her severely disfigured and condemned her to a life of lengthy and painful treatment and surgery, all ultimately futile. A writer and poet, she put her pain on paper in Autobiography of a Face and was launched on the celebrity circuit.
There would be many times in my life when I would just have simply answered that question by saying, I'm ugly. Now I'm willing to concede that my face is actually quite interesting, and not only interesting, but I think there are aspects of it which I find quite attractive. And that sounds like some kind of result of a lifelong self-help program, but it isn't. It's more to do with finally, at the age of 31, conceding that there is no one specific face to which I should be aspiring.
Lucy had never looked bad to Ann Patchett. She's now an award-winning author, but when they met, they were two ambitious, talented, fresh-faced college kids, but so different in every other way. In her new book about their powerful friendship called Truth and Beauty, Patchett characterizes herself as the diligent ant to Greeley's spendthrift grasshopper. It's a searing, soaring tale of devotion which weaves between whimsical anecdotes of two pals out on the razzle to agonizing hospital scenes as Greeley endures physical savaging in the vain hope of one day having a normal, if not beautiful, face. Along the way, the two seem to serve as each other's catalyst, driving both on to literary fame. But the tale ends in double tragedy, the death of the drug-addled Greeley, whom Patchett for the first time avoided seeing at the end. Connection listeners, are there some friendships that dictate the course of our lives? Is it worth it to give up everything to nurture them? At what point does service to a friendship begin to erode the self? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anne Patchett is my guest today. Anne Patchett, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, that very distinctive little voice of Lucy Greeley, I mean, as well as the distinctive face. How did you feel when you heard it?
Well, I was actually thinking how grateful I was that I have listened to that tape about 700 times. Right after she died, I called up Fresh Air and got a copy of it and played it over and over and over again to just listen to her voice. And it was excruciating at first, and now there's a lot of pleasure in it. I always love Lucy's voice, so it's nice to hear it again.
Now, I am always loath to paraphrase writers' works, their stories, which, of course, by necessity, I did in the opening. So take us through it. You call your book A Friendship, and that's what it's about, but that's one word to describe something huge. Tell us about this woman, first of all.
I met Lucy in college at Sarah Lawrence, and I knew her, and she didn't know me. Lucy was a real campus star when we were undergraduates. And it was one of those things where everyone knew everything about her. I knew everything about her, but I hadn't ever really had a conversation with her. So I was always waving to her when I walked by her on campus, and she wouldn't wave back, and I thought she really didn't like me. In fact, she didn't know me. I think that when someone is unusual and compelling, you find out what's going on with them. Where are they from? What's happened? Lucy was so smart. She wrote wonderful poetry. She always gave readings. She was a very public figure at school.
Well, let's go into your first reading, because I think this introduces people beautifully to Lucy and really sums up her charisma, or illustrates her charisma. It's about her film job in university.
All right. It was Lucy's work-study job to run the film series on Friday and Saturday nights, and before she would turn the projector on, it was up to her to walk in front of the screen and explain that in accordance with the New York State Fire Marshal, exits were located at either side of the theater. Only she couldn't say it, because the crowd of students cheered her so wildly, screaming and applauding and chanting her name, Lucy, Lucy, Lucy. She would wrap her arms around her head and twist from side to side, mortified, loving it. Her little body, the body of an underfed 11-year-old, was visibly shaking inside her giant sweaters. Finally, her embarrassment reached such proportions that the audience recognized it and settled down. She had to speak her lines. In accordance with the New York State Fire Marshal, she would begin. She was shouting, but her voice was smaller than the tiny frame it came from. It was no more than a whisper once it passed the third road. I watched this show almost every weekend. It was as great a part of the evening's entertainment as seeing Jules et Jim. Being shy myself, I did not come to shout her name until our junior year. By then, she would wave to the audience as they screamed for her. She would bow from the waist. She had cut her hair off so that it was now something floppy and boyish, a large cowlick sweeping up from her pale forehead. We could see her face clearly. It was always changing, swollen after a surgery or sinking in on itself after the surgery had failed. One year, she walked with a cane, and someone told me it was because they had taken a chunk of her hip to grind up and graft into her jaw.
The constant undercurrent, well, it's the part of the story you just cannot ignore, is this physical torment that was her life. You were almost immediately attracted to her. It was love. And as you say there, there were so many people adoring her. Do you think it was her physical affliction which was so much a part of this? Or was she something which overcame this? There was something so wonderful inside that people forgot to look at the face.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't think about Lucy's physical affliction at all, really. I mean, unless we were right in the middle of a surgery and that's what we were talking about, I didn't see it. I saw it in college maybe for the first few months, and then you forget. You know, you get to know someone, you see them for who they are, you love them for who they are. When we were living together later in Iowa, someone said to me, "How can you stand it? How can you stand to sit across the table from her every morning? You must not be able to think about anything but her face." And I thought that was not only insulting, but really crazy, because who would think of her face? Anyone who knew her knew that she was so amazing and dynamic and full of life. She completely overshadowed her affliction.
You mentioned that when you were first at Sarah Lawrence College, she was unaware of you. It's just because everybody was attracted to her that you were just one of the crowd. Tell us about how you got together, as it were.
We had a mutual friend, Jonathan Wilkes, and when we both got into the Iowa Writers' Workshop, I went in fiction and Lucy went in poetry. I was going to go out to Iowa early to find an apartment, and Jonathan knew this, and he told Lucy, and Lucy didn't have enough money to go out to Iowa to look for an apartment, so she sent me a note, and she asked me to find her a place as well. When I went out there, I couldn't find a place that either one of us could afford separately, so even though it wasn't the plan, I wound up getting a place that we would live together.
How would you define your friendship? Because it's just an amazing love, but a platonic love. It's friendship, you know, it's not just girlfriends, but there was that. Girlfriends was an element of it. You had a lot of fun together.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we had more fun together than anything else. And that's mainly what the book is about. It's about joyful girlfriend love. One of the first people who read this book was a friend of mine who was Lucy's editor on Autobiography of a Face. And she said to me, "You shouldn't call it Truth and Beauty a friendship. You should call it Truth and Beauty a love story, because that's what it is." And then everyone decided that that would get us into murky waters. But it really was a love story. I think that it's so often the case with girls when they're young, they have these intense, passionate friendships, and you say to your girlfriend, "You're my family. I'm closer to you than my family." And then you grow up, and that changes, and the relationships fade or fall into other roles. But for us, that just wasn't true. We kept really a teenage intensity to our girlfriend-dom until the very end.
Yeah, I don't know if you agree with this. It seemed to me that she was everything you were not. You were everything she was not. Both of you, what you did have in common was you were both very talented. You both wanted to be writers. Do you think that what you saw when you looked at her was the catalyst, the person that filled up the gaps in you so that the two of you could actually achieve your potential?
Lucy used to say, if in the perfect world, we would be in a high-speed collision and we would merge into one person and then we would be one perfect person. I think that when we started out, because I had always looked at her in college and thought, she's so cool. I am not cool. Lucy was so hip. And the fact that when we got to Iowa, she wanted to be my friend immediately in an all-encompassing way, I was so incredibly flattered. It was, you know, it's just like if the most popular girl in school comes into the cafeteria and sets her lunch tray down next to you. I just couldn't believe my good fortune. So I think that that's how we started. And over time, yes, we did balance each other out. I was always telling Lucy to have a good breakfast and take her vitamins, and she was always telling me I should go have more affairs.
You were very motherly to her, very nurturing. Did you ever feel you were being used?
No, I didn't. And it wasn't just me. We were all very nurturing and motherly to Lucy. That's what she asked of her friends. And what she gave in return was an amazing childlike sweetness. There were parts of Lucy that seemed to be frozen at 9 or 10, which was when she first got sick. And one of them was, you know, if you sat down on the sofa, she would come over and sit in your lap. If you walked down the street, she always wanted to hold your hand. She always ate off your plate. She was always snuggling up under your arm. When she came to stay with me, she would always get up in the morning and get into bed with me. And there was an incredible sweetness in her that was really like a child. She wasn't embarrassed at all to say, I want love, I want attention, I want your love and attention right now.
Was she very talented when you first met her? She was a poet, wasn't she? Because Autobiography of a Pace almost happened accidentally.
That's right. She was very, very talented. Again, in school, she was absolutely the star poet in Iowa. She was a very big deal. Everybody recognized her as a great talent. And it's interesting because of all of our differences, when I was writing this book, one of the things that I was so surprised about was the incredible similarities of the trajectory of our careers. We published books at the same publishing houses. We wrote for the same magazines. We won the same fellowships. Lucy was a Bunting Fellow at Radcliffe 2 years later. I was a Bunting Fellow. I was at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown. The next year, she got the fellowship. So we were very equally matched.
Do you think competition was really a big part of the relationship?
No, it wasn't. And it wasn't because we worked at it. It certainly could have been, but we kept to our separate corners. She was poetry, I was fiction. And late in her life, she was writing a novel. And she was very concerned about that she felt like she was straying onto my turf. And she was very apologetic. And I don't want to take anything away from you. I know that you're the real novelist. At that point, of course, it didn't make any difference to me at all. I was thrilled that she was going to write a fiction.
We're talking about the nature of friendship with my guest today, Anne Patchett, author of a new book on her relationship with Lucy Greeley called Truth and Beauty. To join the conversation, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, talk to Anne Patchett. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking about the nature of friendship, female friendship this hour, with writer Anne Patchett, who's written about her friendship with fellow writer Lucy Greeley in her new book, Truth and Beauty. And just before the break, we were talking about whether the nature of your friendship was as competition as writers, spurring each other on. You've got another reading from your book about Lucy and you and how you work together or in parallel.
Yes. This is a passage about a hard time for both of us before any breaks had hit. I was working as a waitress in Nashville, and she was in Scotland having a lot of surgery. And the one thing that we felt would make a difference in our life was writing. On this point, Lucy and I were completely united. We had written in college and graduate school and had our small successes, but we were writing to impress our friends, our teachers, possibly ourselves. Now, writing meant something else entirely. Without writing, Lucy was just another patient in a surgical ward, waiting for her tissue expander to fill with saline and stretch out her skin. Without writing, I was just another waitress, like all the other waitresses in Nashville who were waiting for their big publishing deal. They wrote songs. I wanted to write a novel. I was starting to see that it was pretty much all the same. Lucy and I had ceased to be distinguishable from everyone else, and every day the ground was getting softer, swallowing us up a little bit more. We had each come to realize that no one was going to save our lives, and that if we wanted to save them ourselves, we only had one skill that afforded us any hope at all. Writing is a job, a talent, but it's also some place to go in your head. It's the imaginary friend you drink your tea with in the afternoon. In her hospital bed or in her lonesome room back in her flat, Lucy brought out sentences she knew and twisted them into poems and chapters, the same way I stood in the kitchen every night at the end of my shift at Fridays and rolled 150 silverware packets, dreaming up characters with problems more beautiful and insurmountable than my own.
I asked you earlier if you shared competition, and you said no. I wonder then if perhaps what you shared, what I felt from that, was that you recognized in each other that you were special. Did you share a fear that you might not realize that potential, that you might just be anonymous? And for Lucy to be anonymous was, it would deny her the ability to overcome her physical handicaps.
Yes, absolutely. That would be a better way of putting it. But the other thing we shared was ambition. We really wanted to make it. And we wanted to make it in a very dreamy, artistic way. We wanted to be the ones who were writing about truth and beauty. We wanted to make great literature. It wasn't that we sat around dreaming of someday landing on the Oprah show or making a bundle of money. We always thought we would be broke, but we wanted to have real literary merit. We wanted to be important. We wanted to be important when we were dead. I mean, we actually sat around and talked about things like that. Would we make the milestone column in Time magazine when we died? Those were the kinds of things that we worried about, which is actually really crazy when I think about it now.
And there's quite a few people want to talk to you. To talk to Ann Patchett, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Penny's joining us from Boston, Mass. Hi, Penny. What would you want to talk to Ann about?
Hello. I just wanted to say that this is such a fascinating conversation that you're having. I have a friend of mine. I live in Boston, and my best friend in the world lives in California. And it's so interesting when I hear you talk about this sentiment of love. I mean, this taking friendship a step beyond and really feeling like you're having a love affair with someone. I'm getting married in 2 months, and I have to feel like sometimes I feel like I'm having a love affair with my girlfriend, you know, in addition to my fiancé. It's very interesting.
Well, and I have to say, in your book, I did kind of feel that the guys, even if you were terribly in love with them and living with them for a long time, seemed to be sort of a P.S. to your life. Was that true, or was it just the focus of the book?
Well, because my guy is out here listening, I certainly don't want to say on the radio he's a P.S. to my life.
No.
Women
tend to think, though, that, you know, that their relationship with the guy is the central focus of their life and their girlfriends are sort of appendages. It was quite different is the focus in this book.
Absolutely. And there are the girls out there who, if they get a date at the last minute, they'll dump you over. And Lucy and I were not those girls. And the thing that's important to say is I had a lot of very, very close, profound friendships. I'm a very friendship-oriented person, as was Lucy. We were not just two little candles huddling together. We had a lot of friends and a lot of mutual friends. But as far as the caller is concerned, I really understand that idea of finding the balance somehow between that old relationship and the friendship that you love so much and wanting your life to get larger and more expansive. I don't have a television and I'm not a television person at all, but I got really obsessed with Sex and the City because I thought it was a program exactly about this, about adult women who continued to keep their friendship at the center of their life, just like they were still in college. You know, anything that happens, let's all call together and pull together and discuss it. And I think that's so rare with all the demands that life makes on us, that's the friendships that get pushed into a secondary role.
Yeah, we are getting a little bit heavy. I mean, it is a heavy relationship considering the sort of person that Lucy was, but there is a very fun aspect that we found. I mean, we were talking about you had a lot of fun and there was a girly element to it. Can you give us that? It was an engagement party, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. My stepsister was getting engaged and Lucy was in Nashville visiting and we were going to her engagement party. That night there was an engagement party at my mother and her husband's house for my stepsister Marcy and Rob, her fiancé. Somehow all the guests had shown up 45 minutes early so that when Lucy and I came home, we had stopped off at the movies to shake the doctors out of our heads. We were late. We ran through the party and up the stairs to change clothes while guests made wedding small talk and drank wine. I hated being late, and I changed clothes quickly so that I could get back to the kitchen to help my mother pass around trays of canapes. Once I was dressed, Lucy gave me a hard look of appraisal. "What?" "The skirt," she said gravely. "Too short?" It was short, but I had thought that because it was black and I was wearing it with black tights, it didn't make too much of a statement. Lucy put her hand on my shoulder. "I only say this because I love you, because you are my best friend in the world. Tell me. Because if one did not truly love another and feel confident that love was returned, one could never be completely honest." "The skirt," I started. "That's family down there," she said in an instructional whisper. "And you look like a total slut." The skirt, which wrapped over itself in the front and snapped at the waist, came off easily, no doubt part of its slutty charm. I was out of it in 2 seconds and stepping into one that was gray and wool and discreetly covered my calves. My mother had married again a couple of years before, and my relationship with my new stepfamily downstairs was still uncomfortably polite. It was perfectly reasonable to think that they would see such an insubstantial skirt not as fashionable or stylish, but simply, awkwardly cheap. I kissed Lucy's forehead in gratitude. "I love you," I said. "Once again, I owe you my life." Lucy closed her eyes and nodded. "It's all right." Lucy took a shower while I hurried downstairs into the swirl of family below. Or maybe that wasn't it at all. Maybe my family was upstairs taking a shower, and I was walking into a party of lovely strangers. Lucy and I were one another's history. I would see her through her quest for teeth, and she would tell me when I was about to embarrass myself. What constituted family, if not that? 10 minutes later, Lucy came scampering down the stairs, looking extremely sexy in high heels, a turtleneck sweater, and my little black dinner napkin of a skirt. "Gotcha," she said.
She was playful. She was naughty.
No doubt about it.
And chaotic. Mm-hmm. You had two very different ways of going about your writing. I mean, how did you view the way she went at it? She seemed to be the person who went to the deadline and sort of knocked off her book at midnight.
It was true. And because it worked for her, she kept doing it that way. But Lucy was definitely somebody who got her homework in late, and she always went past the deadline. She needed people to be breathing down her neck. I remember when she was writing her novel at the end of her life, and she kept not having the pages, and she would call her editor and say, "I'm having another surgery. There are all these big problems going on medically. I need an extension." And the editor would give her another extension. And I always wanted to call that woman behind Lucy's back and say, "Don't give it to her. Tell her that you're going to come to her house and sit on her chest until she writes the pages." Because in a way, that was the only way she could get things done. Whereas I'm so incredibly Catholic, such a eraser clapper in my nature, I always got everything in, not only on time, but weeks before it was due.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALKS, talk to Anne Patchett, author of Truth and Beauty. Christina's calling us from Jamaica Plains in Mass. Hi, Christina.
Hi.
Just bear with me. I'm a little nervous, but I'm doing this for a tribute to Lucy. I remember when her book came out, I was an adult with it wasn't even like acne. It was worse than acne. And I have very ethnic features, and I ended up staying home a lot and not going out for years and years. And I read her book, and I heard her on Fresh Air, and she had given me quite a lot of courage after what she went through. And she validated what a lot of my experience was, which is just sometimes walking around on the street, like total strangers would actually say things to you, not just stare. And she talked about that happening to her. And at the time, I would even tell other people that it would happen to me. And some people, including people in like a therapeutic community or something, wouldn't believe me. And they would say, oh, you know, maybe you're hearing voices or something like that. And years later, I wrote to her and I told her how she had really helped me. And I really regret she had sent me her email, and I never emailed her back anything. And shortly after that, she died. But
Christina, I think Anne has
said, just incredible.
Christine, was it courage she gave you? Or just to ignore?
She had such nobility about her condition. I mean, I remember hearing her say to Terry Gross that with what she was suffering, she was still head and shoulders above other people, because at least she was white and blonde and looked like sort of the traditional kind of, you know, WASP features that are more standard in the society. And I was amazed that she would have the generosity to say something like that. You know, that she could see, like, people actually parse people's looks, you know, certain kinds of people, like maybe the person that Anne mentioned, like, who said, how can you look at her across the breakfast table? There's a whole, you know, sort of sector of people that actually just are obsessed with that kind of thing and don't look at someone, even someone they don't know. They just completely make a snap judgment and think that they should give them a certain kind of, you know, hostile look. And, you know, it's happened through the ages to people of other races and people who are different or people who look poor or people who are ragged or whatever. And, you know, she was definitely one of the, I guess Ian Forrester said there's an aristocracy of the sensitive, and she was definitely one of those.
Christina, thank you very much for your point. Let's see if we can help inspire other people with Lucy's guts. Here's a little more of when she was on the circuit after Autobiography of a Face.
I think my relationship to my face changes a lot, although perhaps not quite as much as it was when I was younger. In my book, I say at one point that I was unable to distinguish between saying I'm depressed and I'm ugly, because the two had become completely linked in my mind. I really did not know the difference. And now I'm really just like anybody else. I have days where I wake up and I think, oh, God. And then other days I look in the mirror and I think, you know, hey, you know, I don't look so bad.
And the point Christina was making there, that she suffered being gawked at, stared at, yelled at. I mean, you secondhand suffered it whenever you were with Lucy.
I want to thank Christina for being so incredibly articulate and making such a wonderful point. And the bottom line of what I'm doing with this book is my hope is that people will read my book and immediately say, I have to go back and read Truth and Beauty. Oh, excuse me. I have to go back and read Autobiography of a Face. Everything is getting merged in my mind. It is my absolute goal to keep that book alive. I can't keep Lucy alive, but I can keep her work alive and I can promote it. I think that book is so important for exactly the reasons that Christina was talking about. She had such an incredible impact on people because she wasn't okay, and she got incredibly depressed, and the whole thing did wear her down unbelievably. But she still, if there were a group of people standing around, man, she put the talking heads on and she was dancing across the floor in a minute. She fought so hard to say, I really am going to have joy in my life, even if everything isn't perfectly okay.
It's interesting, isn't it, Anne? Because she seemed to live what became her greatest work, and it didn't become obvious to her till near the end that that was the greatest work, was herself, this triumph of her spirit. You know, or she'd been a poet. She didn't come to Autobiography of the Face naturally, did she?
No. And in fact, she never wanted to be famous for her face. She wanted to be famous for her mind. And she was very, very clear on the fact that autobiography of a face was supposed to be inspirational as a piece of art, as a piece of intellectual reasoning. This was not just the sad story of a girl who'd beaten cancer. This was really about writing as well.
How did you actually cope, though, when people had a go at her on the street? Did you feel like slap? Well, you did sort of give people a piece of your mind a few times, yeah.
It's true. I mean, it was like Lucy. You know, you can take it, and then one day you don't take it, and you just absolutely go at somebody. And that changes all of the time. I could be incredibly hostile and direct on her behalf in a way that I never would have been about anything in my own life. But I was very protective of her. And also, it never ceased to strike me as strange. It always caught me off guard because, like I said, I didn't see Lucy that way. I saw her as so beautiful and as so amazing that when people would come up and say, oh my God, what happened to her? It would always take me a second. I would think, what happened to her?
Well, I asked you earlier if you thought that she'd use you, that you were nurturing, you were the mothering kind. Do you think, in many respects, she really gave you backbone?
Absolutely. And you know, what is using somebody? I mean, if you love someone, if you're in an intertwined relationship, you use one another, you help one another, you shore one another up. There were plenty of times when Lucy was on top, when Autobiography of a Face came out, and she was famous, and my career was floundering. My second novel vanished without a trace, and she was the one who was pulling me up and taking me along with her.
Anne Patchett, author of Truth and Beauty, my guest this hour. Connection listeners, I know you're standing by to talk to Anne, and we'll get your calls on right after the break. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking about the nature of friendship this hour with Anne Patchett, who's written about a very special friendship in her new book, Truth and Beauty. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is how you talk to Anne. Suzanne wants to talk to Anne. She's calling from Boston. Suzanne.
Hi. I wanted to say that, well, I read Autobiography of Face, but I also read Truth and Beauty and cried. And you'd said during this talk today, Anne, that one of your goals is, well, you can't keep Lucy alive, but you can keep Autobiography of a Face alive. But also, Lucy's a poet, or was a poet, and I've been looking for some of her poetry using online, and I couldn't. It's not easy to find her poetry.
Anne,
can you give ideas on where to look?
I don't think you're going to find it. And part of the problem was really after Lucy wrote Autobiography of a Face, I don't think she wrote another dozen poems. She really went into essay writing and memoir and doing magazine work after that. And she didn't come back to poetry. She always wanted to. She certainly believed that poetry was the highest art, but she really stopped writing poetry. She had some publications. I know she had a poem in the Paris Review and the Times of London Literary Supplement. I'm trying to think. Plowshare. She had some work in Plowshares over the years. She had published a chapbook. That would be really hard to find, but she never got her book of poetry published.
Suzanne, sorry to disappoint you. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to talk to Anne Patchett. Seema's joining us from Carlisle, Mass. Hi, Seema. Hello, Seema. No, we seem to have lost Seema. Let's go to Andrea calling from Boston. Hi, Andrea. What do you want to say to Anne?
Well, I just wanted to say that I have friendships that I've had since I've been 13 years old, and we're all 34 now, and just sustaining that true, intimate friendship and being honest and open with one another, no matter what it is about, I just could really relate to, and I just want to, I guess, raise my glass to my friends that I love so dearly, Christine and Angie and Diane. And,
how would you define friendship, Andrea? What makes some friendship special? Is it just shared experience? I mean, do you identify with what Anne's been saying?
Yes, very much so. You know, just the open and honesty that these girls have given to me, and as Anne was talking about with Lucy, especially about the skirt, I thought that was hysterical. And, you know, it's such a great bond that you connect with a person and be able to carry that through your life and be able to rely on them and be able to call on them no matter what and no matter what time of the day is just incredible. And, you know, it's just such a special thing to have, and I'm so appreciative of that I have that in my life, as Anne and Lucy obviously had it as well.
Bit out of the remit of your book, Anne, but as I said, I hated praising your work at the beginning of the book because it's so complex, is the whole nature of friendship. Do you think guys have it?
Gee.
I know, I thought I'd put you on the spot.
I'm sure that some guys do. I have known some, but it doesn't seem to be as much a part of men's culture as it is of women's, and it's such a shame because it is an amazing sustaining gift in life to have that kind of friendship. I am now living in the town where I grew up, and my close friends in my hometown are people that I've known since I was 7 years old. And it's amazing to think I picked these girls out when they were seven and we're still friends.
Do you think it's because we're more loyal, or do we recognize somebody who can get into our soul and under our skin faster?
No, I don't think it's that. I think it's that we're talkers. We're much more likely to spill and share. And the amazing thing about the friendships of youth is that you have so much time when you're young. And you've got these friendships where you spend 2 hours a day talking on the phone. I remember I once cleaned out my refrigerator long distance with a friend of mine in Boston over the phone. We both cleaned our refrigerators out together.
It's the easiest way to do it.
And I just, you know, do men ever get together for 4 hours and talk over lunch and then walk down the street and look in shop windows just as an excuse to keep talking? I think that men's friendship tends to be, this is a gross generalization, but based in activity. You know, we'll go to a sporting event, we'll go play golf, we'll go work on a business deal, we'll do something together, we'll paint the house. But just to sit hour after hour after hour and talk, I don't think is as much in men's natures.
800-423-8255. It's as if you gave us a cue, 800-423-TALK. Patty's calling us from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Patty.
Hello. I just wanted to let Anne know that I'm actually a manager in a bookstore, and when Truth and Beauty came out, I realized by reading the preface that it was based on your relationship with Lucy, and so I thought to myself, well, I should go back and read that first. So I have, and I've also, when you had said earlier that you had wrote it to introduce those people that had not read Autobiography of a Face, I recommend them together. I talk to everybody and let them know that they really can't read one without the other.
It's music and, to my ears.
Pardon?
That's music to my ears.
Oh, good. And I just wanted to say real quickly that I myself was in a hospital for many months when I was about 11. And consequently, I live inside my I have my own head. I mean, I don't really go out and seek friendships and whatnot because I'm quite happy living in my own head, although I do relate with people well. And my best friend, my one and only friend that I consider a friend, she has just gone through cancer this past year. And I think the reason we are so close is because we both know that there is that place that we will never share. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Sure, absolutely.
That she will never know what's completely inside my head, nor will I know what it's like to have, you know, chemotherapy drugs pumped into her chest.
Patty, thanks very much for that. Very resonant of everything we've been talking about. 800-423-8255 to join the conversation. 800-423-TALK. Mike joins us from Newport, Rhode Island. Nice to have a guy on the show, Mike.
Yes, thanks, Mike.
Go on, slag off the women. Say it's not true that you have the only good friendships.
Well, good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
I'm enjoying the show, as usual. I just wanted to comment about guys not getting together and for just the reason of talking. And I know myself, I do that with friends quite often, and it goes on for a long time.
Do you clear out the refrigerator when you do it, though, Mike? This is the point.
Well, if you've ever noticed the phenomenon of a lot of guys leaning over the hood of a car, mm-hmm. that's kind of the same thing. But I'm with absolutely no activity attached to it whatsoever. I do get together with friends and for one reason or another, and it instantly devolves into talking for hours about, stuff.
Yeah, what sort of stuff do guys talk about, though? Is it sport, or do you really get under each other's skin and talk personalities?
It depends upon who the people are, and I think sometimes we mostly aim for sports and politics and various types of equipment for the various types of things that we do. But it does get into personalities and stuff.
Mike, thanks very much for your call. Well, it's 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go back to the women. Melanie's calling us from Spokane in Washington. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. I've never read either of these books, and I just happened to be listening this morning, and I just felt so overwhelmed with this feeling of gratitude to both of these women for writing about women's friendships. And, you know, I wondered if it was in my life, if it's been something I didn't learn from my family, because I know my mother never had close friendships. And now I'm 43, and for the last 10 years I've been kind of struggling to want to make these deep connections with women friends. And I just have always been envious of women I know who have this.
Yeah, and that's a point, actually. We pick you up in college in this book, and both of you have a surge of friendship. I mean, was it there anyway? Had you had a life? You said you had friends as a kid. Was it, a gap that was waiting there to be filled?
No, I'm definitely somebody who has always been oriented towards having very close friendships. And one of the things that has been amazing to me with this book is people come up to me and say, quite wistfully, I've never been this close to anyone. I've never had this kind of friendship before, and you're so lucky to have had this in your life. And I think that's an incredibly important point to make, because in so many ways this is a really joyful book, because it's about making a profound connection with someone. And I really hope that you go out and keep working on it and opening yourself up and making yourself vulnerable and making sure you have those friends, because for me it's the greatest joy in my life.
Melanie, thanks very much for your call. Noanne, we can't avoid the fact that this ends tragically. Describe what happened, how Lucy started to go downhill.
Lucy had a very difficult surgery that was going to be a four-part surgery. None of her surgeries were just one surgery, in which they were going to take the tibia out of her shin and graft it into her jaw and then put bolts in her face and one thing or another. It was absolutely science fiction sort of gruesome. And the surgery really went wrong. They couldn't graft the bone and the native bone together. And she'd lost the bone in her leg then. She was in a lot of pain. She was always in a lot of pain. And it was so easy to forget, because Lucy would talk about her emotional pain at the drop of the hat, but she'd never talk about her physical pain. She would take different painkillers. She should have been taking painkillers. She absolutely needed them. She was in enormous physical pain. But one would make her sleepy, and one would keep her up, and one would make her nervous, and one would give her dry mouth. And she went back and forth. There were so many drugs in her apartment all the time.
And then she became a heroin addict.
Yes. Well, she became an OxyContin addict. And after the OxyContin ran out, she became a heroin addict. But I always say she came by it honestly. She came by it through prescription drugs, and she came by it as a person who was in a lot of pain in all of senses. She had tried to kill herself several times. She was in and out of rehab, in and out of psych wards in the last year and a half of her life. And she was just sliding down. She lost her job. She lost her apartment. She did not lose her friends. You know, we all stuck by her. And there were definitely times for each of us when we got tired and we'd take a week off and somebody else would step up to the plate. But she was on a serious decline, and she died from what combination of things, I do not know.
You did stick with her nearly to the end, even though she was borrowing money off you, which you must have known she was spending on drugs. I mean, did you just hope that eventually she'd pull through?
No, actually, I in the last year and a half of her life, I would buy her things. I would pay her rent. I would send checks directly to the landlord. I wouldn't give her cash anymore. And, you know, as far as not sticking by her to the end, I completely did. The last time I was in New York, I didn't call her, but I also didn't in any way see that as the end of our relationship. It just so happened that she died that night that I was in New York.
Do you just think sometimes, if only something, just a little something had been different and she was still here?
You know, I would, in terms of my own decision, feel guilty. But because I know Lucy's friends and because everyone felt guilty, everyone said, if only I had called her, if only I had taken her here or there, or done this and that. And I knew, in fact, everybody had done everything. And Lucy knew that. She died knowing that we loved her and that she loved us. She said it over and over again. I love you. I'm sorry. I'm trying so hard to pull up. But it wasn't as if we had lost touch and then she died.
Ann Patchett, thanks very much indeed.
Thanks,
Ann
for
Patchett.
Having me.
Ann Patchett is the Penn Faulkner Award-winning author of Truth and Beauty. You can find out more about Ann Patchett and her subject, her friend, Lucy Greeley, on our website, www.theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection.